Welcome to Advanced Nuclear, the official podcast of UCAN Power, where leading experts, innovators, and policymakers explore the latest developments shaping the future of nuclear energy.
Welcome to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Howe for UCAN Power. Thank you for joining us. When it comes to the nuclear fuel supply chain, the most difficult challenge is the uranium enrichment process, where the percentage of fissile uranium-235 atoms must be increased in relation to the stable uranium-238 atoms. This is exceedingly hard to do, particularly for enriching at commercial scale, as it requires sophisticated and highly reliable technology, significant capital investment, and a large and costly facility. The original commercial enrichment method was called gaseous diffusion, a process where uranium hexafluoride gas is crammed through a series of filters repeatedly, eventually increasing the percentage of the slightly smaller molecules that contain the U-235 atoms. It's kind of a blunt force method. This process required a huge amount of electricity and over time became uneconomical, with America's last gaseous diffusion plant, located in Paducah, Kentucky, shuttering in 2013. At the time it was closed, the plant used more electricity than the city of Nashville. Yeah, think about that. So a lot of electricity. The second generation, though, is a lot more efficient. This is called gas centrifuge technology. It uses about 5% as much electricity as gaseous diffusion. It involves spinning a tube-shaped rotor at extremely high speeds inside a slightly larger tubular casing. You pump uranium hexafluoride gas into the casing as it spins. Centrifugal force pushes the slightly heavier U-238 molecules towards the wall of casing. The lighter U-235 bearing molecules can then be extracted, and the process is repeated multiple times in hundreds of linked centrifuges until the desired enrichment level has been achieved. These centrifuges have to be manufactured to extremely precise standards, as they must spin in balance for years and often decades without stopping. There's a third generation of uranium enrichment technology on the horizon, and that's what we're here to talk about in this podcast. We're speaking to Stephen Long, the Chief Executive Officer of Global Laser Enrichment, a company that's close to bringing laser-based enrichment to market for the first time anywhere. I recently had the good fortune to visit with Steve and the President and Chief Commercial Officer of GLE, James Dobchuk, to see the laser enrichment in action in a demonstration loop in Wilmington, North Carolina. I can tell you the technology is real. It's impressive, it's enriching successfully at demonstration scale as we speak, and it stands on the cusp of becoming a major and potentially game-changing element of our nation's nuclear fuel supply chain. Steve has the ideal background for his position. He holds a bachelor's degree in systems engineering from the Naval Academy, master's degree in aeronautical and astronautical engineering from MIT, and an MBA from the University of North Carolina's Kenyon Flagler School of Business. He served in the nuclear Navy for 8 years until shifting to industry, where he then spent 13 years with General Electric Hitachi Nuclear Energy and Global Nuclear Fuel in a variety of project management, commercial, and business leadership roles, including 5 years under GLE, with GLE under GE Hitachi's previous ownership. Most recently, Steve served as the Senior Vice President of Business Development for GE Hitachi, where he was deeply involved with the company's small modular reactor and advanced nuclear fuel segments, and he was appointed CEO of GLE in 2021. So, Steve, thank you so much for joining us on the Advanced Nuclear Podcast and for enlightening our listeners about GLE and your work to commercialize laser enrichment.
Yeah, thanks for that introduction, Jim. Really appreciate it. Glad to be on the show.
So your backstory, I mean, as a fellow sailor, I really appreciate your service to the country. And but your backstory, you know, what led you to GLE? You're with General Electric Hitachi for all these years, and then you ended up at GLE. And are you surprised to find that you're leading, you know, one of the most sophisticated technology development companies in the world right now?
Yeah, great point, Jim. It is exciting and definitely surprised. You know, maybe it's a something about my personality, but I like working on really hard and significant challenges. And, you know, as you went through my background at GE, and, you know, I had an opportunity to do a lot of really neat and significant things at GE, including spending time on this project pre-Fukushima while it was a GE company, and went on and did other things in the GE company, Global Nuclear Fuel, for example, and then ran their parts business and ultimately worked in business development for GE. But kept coming back to this exciting technology, the promise it offered for the nuclear fuel cycle, really the opportunity to disrupt and change the paradigm in the fuel cycle, and just a really challenging and interesting problems to solve. And so when given the opportunity to come back in 2021, it was a pretty easy decision.
Well, great. So give us an overview of the company. You know, when was it founded? Who are the owners? Where is it headquartered? How large is the workforce? All the particulars.
Yeah, sure. So GLE was actually founded by GE in 2007. That's right about the same time that GE originally licensed the technology. Like I said, you know, up until the point of Fukushima, GLE was running hot and heavy as a GE company. As we all know, in the nuclear industry, Fukushima really put the entire industry on pause for nearly a decade, and GLE was no different in that regard. And so in 2021, we completed the restructuring and sale of GLE to its current owners, Salix Systems of Australia, which is the original inventor of the technology and the licensor. They own 51% of the company. And then Cameco Corporation, which I think many of your listeners will recognize as the largest privately held uranium producer, vertically integrated in CANDU, and of course a 49% owner in Westinghouse Nuclear Corporation now as well. So we've been around since 2007, really hitting it hard here since 2021 and coming out with the new tailwinds in nuclear. We're headquartered in Wilmington, North Carolina, where we originally started. We've got a headquarters and manufacturing facility that I'm sitting in today. We also maintain a licensed demonstration facility that we call the test loop that remains on the campus of Global Nuclear Fuel and works under that uranium license. Our workforce today is just a little bit over 100 personnel, and we're continuing to grow. So strong presence here in Wilmington, planning to also build a strong presence and start to build our workforce at our site in Paducah, Kentucky.
So laser enrichment, we've talked about the previous generations. How does laser work? And we know that there's, you know, several different types of laser enrichment. Yours is called Silex. Yeah, talk about your type of laser enrichment. How does it work?
Yeah, so just for your listeners, the basics of laser enrichment in general is, as you rightfully pointed out in your intro, Jim, you know, the previous methods use either differences in atomic size or atomic weight to separate the 235 isotope from the 238. Laser isotope separation processes rely on the spectroscopy of UF6 and selectively targeting the 235 isotope versus the 238. You mentioned Avalis and Imlis. Both of those laser isotope separation methods were attempted, and they had fundamental issues with compatibility with the fuel cycle. Avalis worked and was fairly efficient, but it relied on uranium metallic vapors, which created product in metal form, which was incompatible with the existing fuel cycle at the time. Imlis separated fluorine atom from the UF6 molecule, and so there was a chemical change from UF6 to UF5 in the process. Silex process, what makes it really unique is that it has none of those changes in steps. So we use uranium hexafluoride or UF6 throughout the entire process, from feed to separation to withdrawal, and therefore are completely compatible with the existing fuel cycle, use the same front and back end equipment, same containers, etc. The key advantages of laser isotope separation over those previous generation technologies, you know, first and foremost, as I said, the selectivity of the process using these finely tuned lasers allows us to separate the 235 with much greater efficiency per stage or per unit than a gas centrifuge. But the real differentiator for our technology in particular is the throughput. So we're able to achieve much higher throughputs per stage or per unit. And of course, those specifics are, I can't share those specifics, but we're talking orders of magnitude, more throughput per unit or stage than a gas centrifuge. So in a gas centrifuge facility where you need thousands of centrifuges to achieve an appreciable yield to serve multiple reactor reloads per year, we need far fewer units, and our equivalent unit to a centrifuge is called a separator.
Got it. And so basically you're basically flowing a stream of uranium hexafluoride and shining a laser through it, and it somehow excites only the U-235 atoms. Do I have that right? And then they can be separated from the U-238. Is that the basic?
Yeah, that's correct. So we, inside our separator, we pass a process gas that's combined with UF6 and what we call a carrier gas. We pass precisely tuned laser light, which, as you pointed out, consists of photons. Those photons are precisely tuned to tag only the 235 isotopes. That causes those isotopes to behave differently than the 238s in the stream, and we leverage that behavior to extract an enriched product stream and a depleted tail stream, much like other separation technologies.
So you talked a little bit about the kind of the physical advantages of why this is potentially a groundbreaking way of doing enrichment. How cost competitive? Because if your equipment's like super expensive compared to a centrifuge, right, maybe, you know, there's no, how do you evaluate that, the cost competitive nature of your technology?
Yeah, so because of those advantages, and yes, while the equipment for laser isotope separation is somewhat more complex than a gas centrifuge, it's not substantially more expensive. And so those advantages in terms of the throughput and the selectivity we get per stage means that we have far fewer stages, far narrower stages, and therefore significantly lower capital costs than a gas centrifuge facility for the same equivalent capacity. Also, because we are not relying on mass differences, brute force, et cetera, we're using precisely tuned photons, which are essentially energy. It's much more energy efficient than either of the previous generations, and so that translates into lower operating costs as well.
I think it's one thing I saw in Wilmington that's important for our listeners to note is that when in 2007, when GLE was formed, I mean, the technology has matured significantly since then. In fact, there's a lot of fusion companies that are looking at, you know, high volume and high energy lasers, and maybe that's you know, really helped the entire industry, you know, get better lasers cheaper. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Jim. I mean, one of the silver linings of the nuclear industry pause post Fukushima is it allowed. And we're seeing this across the board, right? Not just in our field, but also in the advanced reactor community. You know, other advancements in technology have enabled designs and approaches that previously may not have been economic or may have had challenges. And that's not dissimilar for us. You know, laser technology has come quite a ways in that time frame. A lot of it is actually technology that we were able to advance and work on in-house. And also it gave us a lot of time to optimize the design trade space for this technology. And, you know, with a first of a kind technology, you have a lot of variables to play with to achieve an optimum. And so having that time to refine the trade space has been an accelerant for us and really has put us in the position where we are now. We're coming out of restructuring just a couple of years ago. We're operating a pilot scale demonstration here in Wilmington.
So we'll talk about that in a second. But first, I want to get your sense in a broad strategic view. You know, what is GLE's value proposition to the nuclear industry at this point?
Yeah, that's a great question, Jim. I mean, first and foremost, especially for U.S. and Western utilities, you know, we offer a new cost-competitive source of supply, a diverse source of supply, right? I assume your users are probably aware that if you take Russia and China out of the picture, as, you know, they're not our friends, then our utilities, both current utilities and prospective reactor operators, really only have two choices, and they're not really a choice, right? Two state-owned entities that supply enriched uranium to the Western world today, and they use the same technology. In fact, the very same centrifuges for separation. So we not only offer a new source of competition, but a diverse source of supply and a diversity of technology, right? And of course, U.S.-based. So I think that's first and foremost. With our plans to deploy a site in Paducah, Kentucky, we have an exclusive agreement with Department of Energy's Office of Environmental Management to acquire and re-enrich a large inventory of high assay depleted tails from the decades of production there at the Paducah Gaseous Diffusion Facility. And really, because of the efficiency of our technology, we're able to economically re-enrich those tails to a natural grade or higher, and do so in an economic and cost-competitive way. And that's not just an economic advantage for us, but it ends up being really a single-site solution that not only unlocks a new source of natural uranium, but a new source of conversion. And conversion capacity is a bottleneck in the industry today, as you might know. And of course, in the process, we are cleaning up what is otherwise going to is all a waste right now that DOE has to handle or dispose of. So we're saving the U.S. taxpayers money by reducing the amount of material that needs to be disposed of, and we're turning it in to an asset that U.S. utilities can feed into the fuel cycle again.
And I'm glad you pointed out the fact that this is, you know, material has already been converted, with that being the big bottleneck in the industry right now, the biggest of the bottlenecks. So that's a really good opportunity to kind of get around that bottleneck. So you gave me the tour of Wilmington facility, and we went over to the test loop. Tell our audience about what you're doing at the test loop and how are things going?
Yeah, absolutely. It was great to show you around. The test loop, as far as we know, is the only third generation enrichment operation in the world right now. We call it our large scale enrichment demonstration, or for your viewers who might be familiar with technology readiness levels, our TRL-6 demonstration. And when we talk about large scale, we really do mean large scale. Again, I can't go into the specifics, but we're working with hundreds of kilograms of low enriched material in the test loop, producing enriched product every day. The amount of enriched product that we produce in one run is more than a gas centrifuge would produce in an entire year. And so we are working with significant amounts of material. Obviously, we work within the license constraints of a demonstration license. So the test loop is a closed loop system. We feed in our natural gas. We enrich the gas, extract a product stream and a tail stream. And then when we immediately recombine it and start the process over. Of course, we draw samples, take mass measurements to verify the performance of the system. And I think as of this year, we're approaching about 15,000 hours over the history of the test loop at various scales of systems of operating experience that we've accumulated on our way to commercial scale production.
And when do you estimate that you'll be ready to go commercial, large scale commercial production?
Yeah, so our goal is to be operational by the end of this decade, if not sooner, right? And so we're working hard and moving as fast as we can to scale and de-risk and mature the technology and get it ready for commercial production. Our goal by the end of the decade is really centered around a baseline plan, which is entering the market by enriching those tails I talked about earlier and producing natural UF6 and selling that into the market. And that's really market-based. You know, we see supply-demand gap around the natural uranium market and, of course, the conversion therein that's really starting to open up in that 2030 timeframe and is really an opportunity that's isolated from any other of the dynamics going on in the industry right now, whether it be geopolitical factors, the extent to which and the timing of which advanced reactors take hold or new builds such as SMRs and, of course, large-scale light water reactors. So our overall goal, as I said, is to be operational by the end of 2030. And of course, if we can achieve an earlier goal, that certainly is a positive.
And of course, you can't do any of this without a license. Our friends at the NRC, how is your licensing work going and what's the status?
Yeah, licensing work is actually ahead of schedule. So we submitted our license application at the end of June, about 6 months ahead of our original schedule. We were able to do that for a couple reasons. I mean, one, we previously had a license application that was issued to construct and operate a facility in Wilmington, North Carolina, when we were a GE company. Of course, that license was put on hold after the market downturn post-Fukushima. But the safety basis remained intact, and with the improvements we made to the design since then, we've only eliminated accidents. So we're happy to say that we're the first fuel cycle facility, enrichment facility in line at the NRC, especially under the new executive orders, which have directed the NRC to complete that review in 18 months or less. And so we've had a lot of positive pre-application engagement with the NRC. We expect that licensing process to go very efficiently, and if all goes well, we should have a license in hand by early 2027 at the latest.
That would be terrific for you to do that. That'd be a big achievement too. I can tell you my own experience at Centris with the licensing was very positive. NRC is a great bunch of professionals. They know what they're doing, and we never really had any sort of bottlenecks there. It was always a pretty straightforward process. So good luck with that. But so you talked about Paducah. You know, this is the site of the old gaseous diffusion plant, which is now, you know, being basically dismantled as part of a D&D operation. But it's a massive facility, a lot of government-owned land there, and that's where the tails are that you're going to be re-enriching. So I think you call it the Paducah Laser Enrichment Facility, the PLEF, is that correct?
And that's right.
Yep, and tell us about your vision for the Paducah Laser Enrichment Facility.
Yeah, happy to. So we acquired and own roughly 700 acres there to the southeast of the site. We're actually not on the DOE property. We're just outside the DOE-controlled area. So we're proud to be landowners there in Kentucky, and that's all greenfield property. Of that 700 acres, we plan to develop roughly 190 acres We've licensed the facility to a nominal capacity of roughly 6 million SWU of LEU on a toll enrichment basis and 2,000 metric tons of natural uranium production equivalent per year. So all told, that works out to about 8 million equivalent SWU. The actual timeline and amount of capacity we put online initially will be obviously driven by market fundamentals and customer commitments. As I said earlier, we're planning to deploy that by the end of 2030. That facility, as you might expect, will be a multi-billion-dollar investment at full build-out, significantly cheaper on a per million SWU basis than gas centrifuge, but you know, still quite a significant investment. And then, of course, once we have the initial modules operational, not only do we plan to add additional LEU capacity, but we would eventually plan to serve the advanced reactor market and those who need high assay LEU or HALEU.
Well, you read my mind. That was kind of the next question is, if you're going to be doing re-enrichment of depleted uranium up to natural, and then you're going to be doing LEU, are you also going to be doing HALEU? It sounds like that's a future opportunity for this technology. And there's no problems with the technology going up to pretty much, you know, the 20% level, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. And very, very similar to the existing gas centrifuge technology. The units work the same. You have a different cascade arrangement to go from natural to LEU than you do LEU to HALEU, but there's no changes in the process or no fundamental changes in the technology to go to those higher enrichment levels. Of course, you know, we're very excited about the prospects of advanced reactors. I think they offer a lot of benefits and think that adoption will occur over time. But as you know, Jim, you need more than a few units to sustain a plant of any appreciable size for HALEU. And as a new market entrant, you know, we see HALEU as an opportunity for us to expand when the market is mature and there's enough demand there to baseload our capacity instead of starting with HALEU for the first production out of our facility.
Well, let's talk about a few other kind of peculiars about the industry and about Paducah. I know that Paducah sits kind of near the New Madrid Fault, which makes it kind of close to an earthquake zone. There's been some earthquakes there in decades, centuries right. Past. It's not a problem for gaseous diffusion. It could be a problem for centrifuges, which are very delicate instruments in comparison. Is it a problem for laser enrichment at all?
You know, it's actually not. And you're right, Jim. When you look at the continent, Paducah is actually probably the second worst place in the country to site an enrichment facility outside of the California area if you're sensitive to seismic activity. And so the laser isotope separation process, our process, is really not a hazard from a seismic perspective. Would we shut down in a significant seismic event? Absolutely, for worker safety and what have you. But our process would not be perturbated. We're not relying on machines spinning finely tuned and balanced at very high RPM. In fact, we have made some remarkable advancements in that regard as well that would actually allow us to continue operating in a minor event. We actually developed automated beam alignment and control systems for our lasers, which I could actually go and shake the table tomorrow and the system would align the lasers right back on their path and not really cause a perturbation to the process. So from a safety standpoint, as well as an economic standpoint, our process is pretty resilient to seismic activity.
Which is a really good thing to hear. Now, as far as the actual equipment itself, where will you be manufacturing, you know, the key components?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, as you might imagine, with a challenging technology, a highly intellectual property, proprietary technology, as well as classified technology, we plan from the start to make most of it in-house. We actually have a 70,000 square foot manufacturing facility here that I'm sitting in today, state-of-the-art machining capability, as well as prototyping, assembly, and test. And for the Paducah laser enrichment facility, we will initially produce our components for that facility here at the facility in Wilmington, and then ship them to the site in Paducah and assemble them and put them online. Eventually, the Paducah laser enrichment facility will have its own in-house manufacturing capability as well. For all the other equipment that we're not making in-house, another key component of our strategy from the get-go was to onshore as much of that as possible. First of all, just from a protection of information and export control consideration, We wanted to insource as much of the supply chain. You know, we want to be able to work with our vendors very closely when we're developing new versions of our technology, when we're maintaining it. And really post-COVID, with supply chain impacts and all the other activity going on, not just in the nuclear industry, but in all industries, it's actually become a benefit from a cost and schedule standpoint to try and onshore as much as possible, even when it's available overseas, right? So gas centrifuge facilities in particular source, obviously, a lot of their components from Western Europe. We found supply chains in Western Europe to be fairly difficult to deal with, unreliable in terms of lead times, price, schedule, priorities, etc. And so to the max extent we can, we're onshoring as much as of our supply chain as possible. There's a few things we'll still have to get from Western European providers, primarily in piping, valves, and instrumentation. But long term, we anticipate having 100% or very near 100% of our supply chain on U.S. shores.
And you kind of alluded to this, but it sounds like, similar to gas centrifuge, this is a very modular technology. So if you build a million SWU plant and now you need 2 million, you can just kind of keep building out different modules. Is that pretty much
the case? Yeah, that's right. We've designed our facility for modular construction and operation, and that's informed by a lot of experience and lessons learned we have on our team from other operations in the past. And of course, with the advantages of laser isotope separation, it is a cascade, but it's not a cascade that has a lot of crosstalk like a gas centrifuge cascade. And so not only is the equipment able to produce more per unit, and so we need far fewer units to stand up a new cascade, but it translates into lots of advantages in terms of rolling out modular capacities, different feed and product assays, et cetera, as the market evolves.
So when it comes to the supply chain itself, though, in the post-COVID world, there's been some really weird anomalies where certain materials are hard to get. Are there any significant supply chain shortages that you're facing right now?
I would not say any specific, at least not ones that we could go into on the podcast here. I would say in general, and you probably heard this from other folks you've interviewed, you know, the supply chain, especially internationally, is fairly unpredictable post-COVID. We've seen lead times go far beyond promised dates and costs really be unpredictable between procurements. And so that again is driving our onshoring plan, as well as our in-house make versus buy process. We believe it. We're going to be most successful from a schedule standpoint, a cost standpoint, and a continuity business standpoint if we're able to make as much of our proprietary process as we can in-house. And so that's been a key driver in our decisions to bring in-house manufacturing in this facility here, as well as our strategy to deploy the PLEF and build out our supply chain.
That all makes perfect sense. Now, about those industry and supply chain partnerships, how is that going? Are you allied with, you know, various big vendors? Do you have, what's your customer base looking like? Or are you getting, you know, MOUs and LOIs in place? How's it going there?
Yeah, we actually have LOIs with four of the largest utilities in the country: Constellation, Duke, Dominion, and one other. And those LOIs go in not just to intents for offtake, but also into strategic partnerships in terms of collaboration and really the other initiatives that are required to bring new supply, a new entrant like us, to the market, right? It's more than just offtake commitments. In terms of industry and supply chain partnerships, we are in the process of screening AEs and EPC contractors. I can't go into specifics of who we're working with there, but we are in that pre-screening process and preparing to vet our vendors for the construction of the PLEF.
Got it. So this is a long-term question. Maybe you can't answer this, but I'll ask it anyway. What the heck? How about future plans long-term? I mean, will this be the only GLE facility in Paducah for the U.S., or are there other, I mean, maybe in the future, options to build additional plants if everything goes right?
Yeah, I'd say, of course, there's options to build additional plants in the future. Right now, obviously, we're focused on our site there in Kentucky at the Paducah community. We've got, as I said earlier, plans to develop about 190 acres. That's plenty of room to put more than the licensed capacity we've currently submitted there. So I think, room for this foreseeable future to build out in that community. And of course, it's a great community to have a home. We expect to be there for a long time and be strong partners in the community and provide decades worth of good high-paying jobs. But of course, this technology, subject obviously to security protocols and especially safeguarding the technology, we would potentially look to site new enrichment facilities or additional enrichment facilities in the United States or with our allies.
So you brought up the nonproliferation kind of obliquely. Are there any concerns there? Because, you know, when it comes to any sort of enrichment, we want to safeguard it and make sure that the bad people don't get their hands on it. How about for laser?
Yeah, that's a great question and an important one. The Silex process in particular is actually governed and controlled under a pretty unique treaty between the United States and Australia. The technology was originally conceived in Australia and is Australian flagged. It's called the Silex Treaty, or it's very similar to a 123 agreement. And that treaty contemplated the commercialization of the technology in the U.S. And so the U.S. and Australia agreed to jointly develop and commercialize that technology here, primarily so that the U.S., with our leading nonproliferation standards and practices, could have control of the technology and understand the nuances of it when it's deployed, so that we can ensure that it's not doesn't fall into the hands of those we wouldn't want it to. On top of that, I think since our inception, you know, not only have we protected the technology's restricted data from the very beginning, and so it's not been a matter of, well, we'll take it to tier 04 or 5 and then we'll protect it and try and go backwards and shore up everything that we did out in the open previously. But we protected it to the highest level from the beginning and actually have been a forerunner in information security with our regulators, not just in terms of operating classified computing systems, but also safeguarding the technology and working proactively on nonproliferation standards, information protection, et cetera. I think another misnomer in the non-pro topic area is that a process like ours has a substantially smaller footprint and therefore can be done in a garage. And that's just not the case. As I said earlier, our feed and withdrawal systems, our balance of plant looks very much like a gaseous centrifuge facility. And those systems and equipment are actually fairly large. So you'll see that our Paducah laser enrichment facility is several hundred thousand square feet in footprint. And you know, it's not something you can hide in a garage easily. If you want to proliferate enrichment technology, gaseous centrifuge technology is much more readily available than laser isotopes.
That's a very interesting point. Thanks for bringing that up. But you, when you talk about nonproliferation, it also makes you think about what's happening in different parts of the world. You know, Iran, of course, but with Russia and their exclusion now, they, you know, by law, they aren't allowed to sell any enriched uranium into the U.S. You know, post 2027, and right now it's very constrained, only with waivers. How is that ban on Russian enrichment really impacted your business thinking about bringing this technology to market?
That's a great question. You know, the ban on Russian imports really has opened up opportunity in the low-enriched uranium market segment that otherwise would have been at least 5 or 10 years out, right? And so, as I told you earlier, our baseline plan is to enter the market by taking those tails that are Paducah and producing natural uranium. And again, that was based on supply-demand fundamentals that were there, agnostic to what else was happening throughout the globe. With Russian material out of the market, that does create opportunities for us to enter the LEU market earlier than otherwise planned. Of course, if Russian material or Chinese material starts coming back into the market, you know, that means the market would remain oversupplied and would discourage investment in LEU for folks like us looking to put new capacity online.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And we went through an oversupply period, you know, pre-Fukushima, where there was a lot of extra enrichment. And then, of course, after Fukushima, you know, once you get centrifuges going, you don't want to just stop them. So it kind of, you know, fed itself into an even worse oversupply situation. But let me pivot a little bit. So you've got a pretty unique background. You know, with all your work at GEH on the SMRs and advanced fuels, you know, one of the things that you hear every now and then, most people don't say this, but some critics say that, you know, there's not been enough innovation in the nuclear industry writ large. What's your thinking on that?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, first being part of, you know, what I would consider sort of the original skunk works in the nuclear industry, I strongly disagree with the fact there hasn't been innovation in the nuclear industry. I mean, as you just mentioned, we talked about Fukushima. That's really been the pause or the slowdown in nuclear, right? Especially in the fuel cycle. There's a lot of innovation, a lot of new products. And in my prior time at GE, both in the nuclear fuel side and in our OEM reactors business, a lot of great ideas, a lot of new products to introduce that could yield cost efficiencies or more safety, et cetera. But there just was no market for it, right? And you certainly don't want to introduce new capacity, whether it be fuel fabrication or enrichment, into a market that was already oversupplied and your factories were underutilized. So you're really, the nuclear industry is capable of innovation, and every industry needs new entrants with fresh set of eyes to bring new ideas to the table, and I think that's all great. But the stalwarts in the industry, your OEMs, your GEs, your Westinghouses, et cetera, they're full of bright people who are capable of innovating too and are really innovating in responsible and interesting ways. And so in my experience at GE, what I found to be most important in terms of bringing new nuclear to the table is obviously first and foremost, we have to be safe. You know, in the nuclear industry, when we're trying new things and prototyping new things, we don't get to have our prototypes explode. And so you got to meet safety first and foremost as a fundamental, but more importantly, we have to be cost competitive, right? And a large part of that is going to be eventually standardizing on a few designs that can be produced and deployed in mass quantity scale. One of the biggest things I saw in my experience running the parts business at GE, you know, the GE reactor fleet, there was basically six generations of boiling water reactors, but no two units were alike. And so for whatever fleets are established going forward, a key will be standard parts, modular parts, fundamental design considerations, standard design considerations that really prevent a lot of those boutique plants from being deployed.
Which is something you've embraced at GLE. So that's, you know, kudos to you for that. I just throw up I actually agree with your assessment. I would add that I think until the last couple of years, as Congress and now the Trump administration have taken pretty concrete actions, there was a regulatory hurdle that you had to get over with your innovations. And now it seems like the innovations are flowing, like all the stuff that's been kind of pent up is now able to come out and be tested. You get this demonstration test reactor program where they're trying to get a couple of reactors critical by next summer. That's amazing. And people are running around like crazy trying to meet that. That's the sort of innovation that I think the nuclear industry is capable of. And now we're seeing in the enrichment space, you know, GLE and some other, you know, folks out there are entering the market where it's always in years past been dominated by a lot of, you know, large, you know, state-owned corporations, basically. So I think this is a very incredible period for nuclear. And I like the fact that, you know, we have an administration that is serious about getting kind of any procedural hurdles out of the way so we can move forward safely and effectively to bring these technologies to market. So what should we be looking for next, though, from GLE?
Yeah, well, first and foremost, we're looking to complete our TRL 6 test program, our test of demonstration here by the end of the year, and should be putting out news in that regard as we get closer to the end of the year. And of course, like other entrants in the space, you know, there's a current solicitation out being run by the Department of Energy Office of Nuclear Energy for new low-enriched uranium capacity. We're one of six participants selected to bid on that opportunity, and that bid is coming due here shortly. That's actually how I'll be spending my weekend. So we hope for good news in that, and obviously decisions in that regard would help us accelerate investment decisions on the PLEF and move even faster. So I think those are the near-term milestones for GLE.
Well, it's certainly an exciting time for the company. So congratulations on everything you've accomplished so far and good luck in the future. But now it's a time where I give you your closing thoughts. Anything else you want to share with our audience? And then we'll wrap things up.
No, Jim, I really appreciate the time on this call today. As we've talked about, it's a very exciting time for the nuclear industry, extremely exciting time for the Global Laser Enrichment team here in Wilmington. I'm extremely proud of the work the team's doing every day. Our engineers are working extremely hard. They're They're very focused. We like to joke they're laser focused. I'll save you the pun there. But most importantly, getting a little bit better, a little bit faster every day, and looking forward to good things to come for us as well as the entire industry.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for your insights on laser enrichment and GLE's path towards commercial deployment. We'll be keeping a close eye on your progress, and we wish you all the best for success. To our listeners, please be sure to check out GLE at www.gle-us.com. For the record, Steve, you have a terrific team of professionals in Wilmington. It was an honor to spend some time with them. So thank you for joining us on this podcast. But please pass along my sincerest appreciation to your entire team for their generosity in showing me around the other day. So thank you for that.
Absolutely. Will do. We were very proud to show it off.
All righty. Well, thank you, Steve. That'll do it for this episode of the Advanced Nuclear Podcast. UCAN Power believes that advanced nuclear technologies are key to powering the American economy in the years ahead and are critical to our energy and national security. If you want to learn more about us, you can find us on social media and at ucanpower.org. Special thanks to the team at UCAN and to our dedicated producer, Ms. Kimberly, for all of her terrific work in bringing this show to life. Until next time, this is your host signing off, and thanks to you for tuning in to the Advanced Nuclear Podcast.